Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Robert Ferguson about his book, The Hammer and the Cross, A New History of the Vikings. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour for our members. And we're going to continue talking more now about, the Vikings and, of course, what happened and all that. And there's so many questions I have for you, Robert. I feel, as I always do, that I won't have time to squeeze it all in there, but we'll do the best we can. Let's talk a little bit more about the sources now and what we can trust and not trust when it comes to the Viking Age. This, of course, has been a raging debate, but we have examples where it seems to fall outside of that, and then we have example where it seems very good and all that. But what sources did you go to, and what do you feel is trustworthy?
I think absolutely the most trustworthy sources, of course, are the runestones. They simply cannot be fabricated. They're the number one most trustworthy sources. For a long time, people used to believe that the sagas were more or less historical records, but I think most people now realize that these were written much later, and that they're a little bit more like novels with a basis in history. You have the chronicles, for example, particularly in the Christian world, you have the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, you have the Royal Frankish Annals, you have the Annals of Ulster, the Annals of the Four Masters, these Irish. The Irish were very early annalists and chroniclers. All those things are reliable in the sense that I think in terms of the events, the historical events they describe are reliable. But one always has to bear in mind that they are, when they're talking about Vikings, they are, let us say, that they are prejudiced against them for very good reasons, that they're the victims of their violence, their unprovoked violence in many ways. So that one has to have a slight reservation about them, because there's also the possibilities, of course, that they have allowed themselves to allow their prejudices to run away with them, and that they've exaggerated the sort of behavior that the Vikings have been getting up to. So one has to keep a certain slightly cool head when you're reading these annalists and chroniclers from the early Christian period. Everything's interesting in many ways. I mean,
right.
I think another fairly reliable source is in a lot of the sagas and in Snorri Sturluson, of course, he quotes poetry. And there's a fairly generally accepted view that when poetry is quoted, skaldic poetry, because it's metrical rules and the rules of its construction were so, it's an anachronistic term, but Baroque, they were so elaborate and complex that you couldn't really imagine someone would invent them. You must think that if he's quoting, Snorri is quoting a 9th century poem or a 10th, that it really is telling you what happened. It's an authentic document. And often in a saga, for example, like in the saga of Hallfred, which we mentioned earlier, Hallfred von Vreðaskáld, the troublesome poet, that's really a saga spun out of the extant poetry of Hallfred, so that we can genuinely feel, for example, in Hallfred's case, that this is what he really and truly felt, what he really and truly thought. Whereas the story that spun around or out of the poetry need not necessarily be actual factual history.
Right. So, yeah.
Especially with later written things from the 11th, 12th, and 13th century, you'll have to be a little bit careful.
Yeah. Exactly. And so the way, I guess, scholars have gone about this is basically to try to correlate as much material as possible. In other words, you can look at something which is described in a saga, you can look at something which is inscribed on a runestone, and then you can go to, you know, the primary chronicles of the Slavs or the Gesta Danorum or something like that, and try to piece together that, wait a minute, this event probably describes the same thing, a similar name shows up here, etc. So is there a lot more, in your opinion, of things that needs to be done here, or with the sources that we have available, is like, have we reached that point of where we know what happened now, kind of thing, right?
Well, no, I don't think, I don't think we'll ever reach that point. I mean, as you were talking, and I was just thinking of the saga. I can't offhand remember the actual title. It's probably Yngvi, the Far Traveler's Saga, which is more or less a kind of later explanation for the Yngvar stones, which is this I forget exactly how many, but 24, 25 runestones commemorating all the lost men who traveled with Yngvar way down towards the Black Sea way down to what is now Russia. And the saga, the saga that appeared later, illuminates in its own way what happened, because nobody knows. It just says on these runestones that they went south in search of gold and they made food for the eagles and so on. And you just get the impression of a sort of disaster, hardly any of them came back. And this saga is a sort of construction based on, it's very hard to say. I mean, I'm only mentioning this because a lot of the detail in it is very seductive in a way. I mean, there's a cross-reference there to a few lines in Adam of Bremen's the deeds of the Archbishop of Hamburg, Bremen. There's a sort of cross-reference there. So that it inclines you to think that that saga about Ingvar the Far-Traveled is based on some kind of oral memory, something that was remembered and passed down from mouth to mouth, generation to generation. But I don't think, of course, history, you know, as well as I do, that there is no ultimate truth in any of these things. It's there's so much subjectivity involved in the telling of history.
Yeah, definitely. Now, have you looked into anything like, there's other couple of things that people can use at their disposal? For example, name placements or etymology of placements of towns and what have you in
that is
Sweden.
That is interesting. I mean, I think we spoke earlier about the way Viking history in particular has become a field for specialization. So that, and this is such a complex area, etymologies, place names, and so on. I haven't personally been deeply into it, but I have made use of what etymological scholars have come up with. For example, from my own home country, England, for example, the whole of the Danelaw down from York down to East Anglia, which was more or less Viking territory for a good 40 or 50 years, I think. So many of those place names there. Let me try the Grimsby, for example. You probably heard of Grimsby.
Yeah.
Grimby, either a name, it's one of Odin's names, but it's also a common Viking name. Lowestoft, Toft, Scunthorpe, Toip. There's evidence of place names from which, if you're a dedicated scholar of these things, you can find out all sorts of information from place names.
Yeah, exactly.
In the British Isles and to a certain degree, lesser degree in Normandy and so on. But it's very striking actually in the British Isles, Knutsford as we call it in English, Knutsfjord, all sorts of things. Hesketh. Up in the Wirral near Liverpool, there was a very big Viking settlement up there. A lot of place names there up in my part of England I come from in the northwest. A lot of those place names are Viking place names.
Yeah, that's right. Even some of the words themselves, like sky and anger and what have you. There's a lot of words that lingers on still. And then, of course, you have on top of that, you have geography as well. In some cases, you do have geographical descriptions of areas in the sagas and whatnot, and I know that some people have looked at those kinds of things as well to find where something took place, for example, like a famous battle or something like this.
Yeah, certainly. And it's sort of strange anomaly too, is it, if we go up way up to the Northern Isles, Shetland and Orkney, off the northern tip of Scotland, almost none of the place names there. We know the Picts lived there. But almost, in fact, none of the place names are Picked. They are all Viking or Scandinavian place names. And this is a strange anomaly. Nobody's ever been completely. It's very persuasive to think that they massacred all the Picts at a certain point, very early on in the Viking age. It was only 24 hours by sea across from Bergen. And it's very hard to explain why every single name for topographical features like rivers and mountains and so on, that they should all be Scandinavians. If Picts lived there before, you would think that if they simply subdued the Picts, they would use the names that the Picts had given these mountains and rivers.
Yeah.
But they're all Scandinavian. So yeah, there's a hell of a lot to be learned from place names, and it's a very thought-provoking subject.
Yeah, I remember this chapter from your book and reading about the possibility that either it was due to peaceful relations and this was something which occurred kind of organically, or basically we're talking about some kind of mass genocide to a certain extent there too. So we don't know, right?
we don't know, or a mass flight, even if they all ran away and there was nobody left to tell the Vikings what the places were called.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, that's right. So can you tell us a bit more about the mounds in Norway that have yielded these fantastic finds with the ships, of course, Oseberg ship and all these things, but the amount of mounds that are around all over Scandinavia. I mean, I've visited tons of them this past summer and did a lot of excursions and, you know, looked at some of the different ones in Skälvum, and there's tons of these. And even the local legends talk about that these are important burial sites, but the excavation work hasn't been as detailed. The Royal Academy in Stockholm, they have an approach to this now that their job is to preserve and protect the mounds, not to do investigative or you know, invasive investigations into them. You know, I feel that frustration over we don't know what's in there, and even some of the radar findings haven't been that accurate and that good of what they've been trying to find, you know. So my point being, there might be several more Ossebergs out there, right? But we don't know.
Yes, I agree. You know, there is I think if they discovered the Ossebergs mound now, they wouldn't have opened it, or they would have left the ship where it was in some way. I'm not sure. I think it's worth investigating. I think you should dig them up, really.
I think so too.
I don't think there's any. There's a kind of exaggerated respect for. I mean, obviously we're talking about things that have been there probably 1,500 years in many cases, 1,000 years, and it's so important to know about the past. You know, it's just the past is the only textbook we have to try and learn where we've been and what to do the next time certain types of things happen. And I think the more we know about the past, the better it is. So I would, if I had reasonable ground to believe that there was something inside a mound, I think I would go for it.
I think so too. I'm very frustrated about this. And in fact, I know that there is a lot of, you know, debates back and forth about this. And there's of course, a preservation argument. But at the same time, I feel that there's not the willpower and the drive, or maybe it's a financial thing. Who knows, right? But in some cases, what good is it if they just lay where they are? I mean, you can literally see in some of the mounds I've visited that they have the tip of the mound has collapsed. It's sunken in, which implies that something underneath inside of the mound has sunken together, meaning there could be a ship or coffins or anything of wonder in there. You know?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting to hear you say that. One of my favorite places to go to is Bodø. Have you been to the Bodø?
No, not yet.
Yeah. Well, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a wonderful place. And they have many mounds there. And there's a passage in the Royal Frankish Annals. It's a very difficult story to tell. There's a passage in the Royal Frankish Annals that describes how at the very beginning of the 9th century, two Danish kings are reported to have traveled over the Vik, taken an army because their underlings, if you like, in the southeast corner of Norway were refusing to pay taxes, refusing to pay tribute, and so on, and that they had gone to, as it were, sort this situation out. Now, many of the mounds in Bodø have exactly this, what you're talking about. This sort of, it's almost like a collapse.
Exactly,
it's a collapse of the part of them. And one theory I saw was that, in fact, because these mounds were symbols of power, visible for miles around, this is why they were built. This is why they were built, to symbolize the power of the family whose chieftain lay in there. And that since they had this symbolic aspect, that if you wanted to punish a recalcitrant people or a family, then the thing you would do would be to destroy the symmetry of that mound, so that they may have deliberately cut a wedge into the mound in order to punish.
Interesting.
Teach a lesson. Yeah, I wonder about that a lot myself. You know, one hears so much about the grave robbings and so on. I mean, Ossebergs was broken into, things were stolen there.
Yeah.
The bones were found in a kind of chute that had obviously in disarray, that people had been in there stealing things. And it's very interesting. But you know, I think just open them up and see what's there. If you really think there's something there, let's let's get in there.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I mean, unfortunately, the name escapes me now. There's just so many of them in, you know, in southern Sweden. I've been around and visiting a lot of them, but there's this one that they did excavate in a strange, I don't know how it occurred. It was something which someone who took it upon themselves, I think it was many years ago, and they did it. And of course, they did discover a grave and you know, parts of, you know, ships and things like that in there. And I just feel that in a lot of these, there are things to be found, but it's such a long period as well. We don't know. I mean, even think about it, even from the 1200s, let's say, all the way up to the 1800s before these things were protected, any number of people could have dug in and gone into some of these things, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you a little bit more here. I guess switching gears a little bit here, but there's so many different angles I want to ask you about here. But let's just talk about Odin a little bit. I wanted to get to the origins of where you think that the Norsemen or the Odin people came from. And we have the speculations of the Black Sea. We have they were called the Æsir, and I know that some people have connected this to other parts of the world. Like, well, some say Asia in itself. Some, like Tor Heyerdahl, says Azerbaijan in the around the Black Sea as well. Where do you think the origin point is here?
One of the difficulties with that is that there are two completely different stories about Odin's origin. One in which he's a god, and the other, which is from Snorri, in which he does possibly because he was experiencing too much trouble from the Romans, began heading up north through Europe and eventually settled up in Scandinavia. I find it's not something I've studied particularly, but I have an instinctive problem with the whole idea of the language. If this whole tribe emigrated from as far south as that, then one would think that they would have taken the language with them in some way, and yet, rather than invent a completely new language or adapt a completely new language. So I have a real problem just on that simple score. I think basically my basic view of that is I simply think that Odin was just a great chieftain. Thomas Carlyle in his Heroes and Hero Worship advances that theory, that this is a chieftain who was so great, whom his people loved so much, that the greatest possible way they could reward him was to turn him into a god. But I don't think, I mean, I think the Æsir and Æsir and Arthur, I don't think, to me, that's kind of what you call folk etymology. It sounds a bit similar. It's a simple coincidence. I don't think there's any meaning behind it at all.
Yeah, because I guess I've been going back and looking at some of the things like the Æsir and Vanir war, and these stories gives us an idea that there must have been, you know, conflict between these different people for various reasons. And we even have place names in, what today anyway is Sweden, of both Von name, that name is very common, and also we have the Alvir, and of course we even have a Alvhem today, right in Bohuslän, you know. So there are placements here, maybe there were different tribes at some point, and some of them came up there, and there were an ancient conflict of some kind, who knows, right?
Well, I think that there's one theory that whole idea that, for example, there were some of the Æsir were sort of given over as hostages after presumably peace negotiations with the Vanir, and vice versa, that the Æsir got Njord and they got Frey and Freya, who were Vanir, and the Vanir got, I think it was Hermid, with Mimir to advise him. And I've seen one supposition that is some kind of faint echo of a tribal war between the Vani, which was a kind of a nature worshipping sort of fertility god religion, which met a slightly more advanced form of religion in the form of the belief in Odin.
Yeah,
that is one explanation for that. But these things are just a typical thing that's lost in the mist of time. Really, one cannot know. But that's an interesting theory, because that exchange of hostages does suppose peace and the peace negotiation, because the exchange of hostages would always follow a peace negotiation. So it may well reflect a genuine war between those two tribes.
Yeah, and I've even heard the aspect that the Vanir was a more kind of a nature-prone people. You can see that in the distinguish of the different gods, as you said, as well. And the Æsir was more warfare, more technological, it seems like, right?
Hmm.
Now, Tell us a little bit more about Norse mythology or heathen cosmology. We don't hear too much about this and what they actually believed in. What were their worldview like?
Well, it's difficult. It's one of the things that because they didn't have this very developed written culture, that when that came to be written down by Christian scribes after the introduction of institutionalized Christianity, of course, when a lot of this stuff was simply either ignored as facile superstition or not worth recording, or if they did record it, as was the case with astronomy and the names of, I personally think the names of constellations, star names, they simply gave them the Latin names and ignored the native names. Of the cosmology is, it's opposition of heat and cold and this rather magical appearance of the cow and the cow that licks up a human shape and the various giants appear. It's like a fairy story, really. The interesting part of it is when Odin comes along with his two brothers and they. The explanation for the visible physical universe is that they kill this giant called Ymir and just throw his body parts into the great nothingness and people it, populate it, so that his bones are the mountains and his eyes are the stars and his flesh is the landscape, his blood is the river and so on. I think something that interested me particularly, because it was really so obscure and so little noticed, I think, is the astronomy of the Vikings. And I think that they must have had a fantastically developed astronomy, being such good sailors, that they would need this.
Right, yeah.
But very few of the star names, constellation names, have come down to us. There's one that's not as Sturluson mentions called Thjalfi's Eyes, which I think probably corresponds to our Castor and Pollux in Gemini. And that is, he explains that what happened was that some Loki, one of the Æsir, had got up to some kind of mischief, and it led to the apples of youth that belonged to the Æsir falling into the hands of a giant called Thjalfi, and they had to kill this giant to get him back. And his daughter, called Skaldi, turns up in Asgard and demands revenge. And there's a little package of consolations that the Æsir offer, and one of these consolations is that Odin offers her father immortality in the form of, he throws his eyes up into the sky, which is where they stick, and that's why they're called Thjalfi's Eyes. There's another one called a star called Aurvandil's Toe, which is explained by Snorre as part of Tord had been away fighting giants and came back, and he met a dwarf trying to get across one of the cosmic rivers, and he carried him across in a basket on his back, and this little dwarf called Aurvandil, his toe froze, and I suppose to prevent him getting frostbite, Tord broke it off and threw it up into the sky, and that's Aurvandil's toe. And I've seen some astronomers think that it's probably the star Alcor in the Great Bear. It's a tiny little star up there. But it's very frustrating to hear these stories and know that there must have been dozens of them.
Yeah.
And that all that remains is it's almost like a little sad echo of what was once probably a brilliant storybook of images and tales and so on. All of them telling us something about. Viking Age cosmology and what they believed.
Yeah, it's we don't know what's been lost here, or as we said before, what was, if anything, was written down, or even the word that was passed. I mean, we know from other cultures as well, they have an oral tradition. They didn't have writing; they passed it down. These were the stories they talked about around the campfire at night, and I guess even the idea of having to write them down was so foreign to them, because this is who they were. The very stories was what kept all of them together, right? It was like there's no need to distinguish something which is such an integral part of you, right?
That's right. Yeah, and also, you know, I this makes me think too of the huge importance that the Skalds had to those societies, because they were the caretakers of the law, and their poems, these very elaborate poems that involved kennings, these elaborate metaphors, which are sometimes three or four or five metaphors away from the actual thing they're referring to.
Yeah.
So you had to be really smart. You really had to know your Old Norse lore to make sense of the poem. And the more elaborate your kenning was, your reference steps were, the greater the poet you were. And that is why, to go back to Holford again, that's one reason why I think the poet, Skald, more than anybody, resisted the arrival of Christianity, because it meant the disappearance of their whole poetic world. It meant, I mean, I think it was Olaf Tryggvason, I can't remember, but I think he forbade people to make poetry if they couldn't do it without mentioning the old gods. And of course you couldn't. You couldn't do it. The whole of that poetry, they were the caretakers of the old law, and that is why they were among the very last to be seduced into the new religion.
And would you say that a lot of the, maybe some of the poems, maybe some of the sagas themselves are, what should we say, multi-layered? I mean, for example, we have maybe metaphors and life lessons poured into them. They tell a story about something that happened, but at the same time, they reveal something about something which could be beneficial to something living at this time. For example, about sacrifice, or you have to give something to gain something, be that knowledge or, you know, what have you. Do you think that that's part of the sagas as well?
I don't know. I've never gone into that aspect of the sagas. And the sagas are all so different, you know, in their nature, they're so very different. I think that may well be the case, more obviously the case, if you like, with the Eddic lays, you know, the Eddic poetry of Vafthrudnismal and the Völuspá and Hávamál, for example. They have advice in them, but I don't know. I tend to think probably, and I, you know, this could be just modern prejudice, but I tend to think that in a lot of ways, the sagas are primitive literature, you know. And I don't know that they would be capable of thinking, and also, of course, they're not contemporary, 99 times out of 100, with the actual events they describe. No more than a Western is contemporary with a true picture of the goings on in the Wild West in the 1870s and 1880s.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if there may or may not be hidden depths in there. But I mean, who knows? Who knows? This is again a subjective thing. If you find the hidden depths there, then there's no reason why they aren't there.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. I think you're right. Though on top of it, they're talking about real things and real events. And I think also very possibly the gods themselves are our ancestors, and that their stories have been passed on, and when this happens, they become mythologized, or however you want to say that occurs. And I think there was a veneration for the ancestors there already by default. So this over time would have cost these ancient old people their ancestors to become like gods to them. So I think you're right on that note.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us more about, let's say, law and order in Viking society? Because some people think it was lawless, and it was these heathens were just, you know, barbarians running around with a loincloth, and that was about it. But honor and shame, let's say, as tools in order to maintain social order, is there anything you can say about these things?
Well, I think for a start that they had law was their king. You know, that was, for example, that was what was said in Iceland. The Icelandic Commonwealth, which survived from the settlement in around 300 or 400 years, that without a king, and that the law was their king. I think there was huge respect. There was huge respect for the law, and it wasn't written down until after Christian times. But what you get is, for example, in Iceland, to go back to that, we talked about Thorgeir earlier. One of the law speaker's functions, and he was the single most important man in Icelandic society in many ways, because it was his function to remember the laws and recite a third of them every year at the Althing, so that every third year you had the whole of the law code recited. Just in parenthesis, it means that they must have had fantastic memories and known fantastic memory tricks that we can note things down, we don't need to remember things. I think they must have had fantastic memories in those days, much more developed memories than we have. But law, yes, I think law, most of the laws, when they came to be written down, most of them, and some of them could trace back, obviously, to a time before they were written down. Most of them seem to involve the community in a very strong sense, so that witnesses are always an important part of any kind of judgment, be it a divorce or a trade agreement or something, some argument over this, that a great number of witnesses are brought to speak. If things were done in public, if agreements were made in public, if obviously contracts were entered into in public, then the shame would be known to everybody if you broke that contract, if you reneged on that arrangement.
Let's just talk a little bit more about some of the, I guess, what you see as some of the more extraordinary accomplishments of the Vikings, of what they managed to do. Again, as we said before, the it's a long time, it's in different parts of the world and what have you, but surely, I mean, just to give a brief summary here, we have established trade with the Arab world, we have a connection with the Middle East, as far as Persia, there's down to Constantinople with the Varangian Guard. There's other people who have speculated that they even reached Northern Africa, which that's a speculation, I guess, but we know that they reached America. I mean, a society that managed to accomplish this have not only skills in shipbuilding and organization, but technology and extraordinary navigational skills. So what should we kind of take with us when it comes to the accomplishments of what the Vikings did?
I think basically you've enumerated it there. It was fantastic spirit of adventure, a fantastic expression of boldness, of curiosity about the world. They also had some of the artwork is beautiful. Some of the intricate, like the little cup found in the Yelling Mound. It's an acquired taste, but I find the runestones and runic carvings fantastically beautiful to look at. In terms of achievements, I don't know. They played their part. They traded. Yes, what did they add to the world? I'm not completely sure. I mean, they certainly gave Scandinavia a very good start. They moved Scandinavia into modern times in the sense that monarchies and individual nations, the Swedes, the Danes, the Norwegians, emerged as nations from what the Vikings had established, if you like. Almost all the first kings were formerly Vikings who became kings.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about when you think that the Viking Age ends and what contributes to the fall of it. I think you talked about in the book that there were battles with between Norway and Ireland as late as sea battle at sea in 1200, something like that.
Of Largs, is that the Battle of Largs?
Yeah, exactly. There are echoes of this very late in the process, right?
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be, you almost have to be dogmatic about this and just choose. I mean, a lot of people, particularly in England, closed the Viking Age in 1066. They just end it there because as regards England, that's when it ends. But in my book and personally, since I tend to see this whole period as having such an important element of cultural change and cultural tension, I tend to end it with the establishment of the Archbishopric of Lund in 1104, which was part of Denmark then, 1104, because that to me is the point at which the Church of Rome realizes that heathendom really is finished. It really is not going to rise up. It's not going to flare up again. Then they can safely give the job of looking after, in a religious sense, looking after Scandinavia. They can give it to native Scandinavians in Scandinavia, because up until that time, all the responsibility for Scandinavia had been that of the Archbishopric of Hamburg, Bremen. But to me, this establishment of Lund in 1104, it's the final, it's the closing of the book on heathendom in many ways. It means that they are now part of, if you like, the family of European family of Christian peoples, and that there is no way back. So that's when I ended. But as you implying, really, it's a subjective thing, and it depends where you're looking from. You know, sometimes you look at Wales, for example, and it almost appears as if Wales had no Viking Age at all. Gotland had its own type of Viking Age, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's really where you're standing and what you're looking for. I mean, the whole thrust of my book was really, as I said, that this is a cultural collision that went on for a very long time. And it always actually fascinated me that this poet, I think he was Olaf Haraldsson's poet, what was his name, Sigvat, that in the early decades of the 11th century, he's making poetry in which he's invoking the deeds of the members of the great heathen army who conquered England for the first time in the middle of the 9th century. They had a very, very strong sense of historical identity as Vikings. This is stuff that had been remembered for 200 years. So that I find that very fascinating. But as a Briton, for example, as an Englishman who wrote that book, I think it's very interesting to see what happened when the Yelling Dynasty, the Danish kings, actually take over in England. And you get Svend Fortebeard, and then you get Knut the Great, and that brief North Sea Empire, which is the only true Viking empire that ever was, in which Knut is the king of Denmark, and that, of course, includes a lot of Skåne and southern Sweden, and of Norway, and of England, the British Isles. And it's an extraordinary power base. And I think he just had bad luck with his sons. I mean, history's full of just chances and so on. And had the succession been more secure, who knows what would have happened? You know, then probably there wouldn't have been a William the Conqueror. There wouldn't have been a 1066 in England.
Right.
But then history is full of that kind of conditional thought.
Exactly. It could go... It could go either way there. Exactly. That's
sure.
Yeah. I think as a Swede, I definitely mark the destruction of the great heathen temple. That's where I see, you know, everything changes after that point. And it's just, you know, and I'm so curious to know where it really was located, how it was like. And we do have a couple of sources for it. Of course, Adam of Bremen, he mentions, you know, the temple, although he wasn't there personally. And this is, I guess, some of the reasons for why there's been speculation as to where it really was and whatnot, which I definitely understand. But do you think there are going to be any finds in the future, continued things that will add on to our knowledge of where things were and what happened and all this? Or is there much more to discover, in your view?
I'm sure there will be. And as regards Uppsala, I'm not sure how much investigation has been done of the actual site there. But you would think that if they had these enormous festivals with the sacrificing of animals and humans and whatnot, you would think there would be, and the temple, of course, you would think there would be some sort of archaeological evidence of that.
Sure, yeah.
And exactly. They haven't found any, have they?
Not there. I mean, there was an interesting find in 2013 actually made. I don't know if you heard about that. And that's in Gamla Uppsala, up in the Stockholm area, Uppland.
Yeah.
And there were two lines of large poles that were discovered. I think there were 172 or something like that in total, like a long row of them, and they've still doing some excavation and investigation. I think they were digging down some broadband or new road or something when they discovered these, but it still didn't look like a temple site. It looked more like a, who knows, just a long row of and as what adds on to the difficulty here as well is that we know that the ocean has retreated and the water line was different even, you know, 1,000 years ago than they were. And some places might have been a port, which are not today, you know, so there things change over time, right?
Sure. That's very interesting. I'll keep an eye out for that.
And I personally, of course, have my own doubts about Uppsala. I was to another location in Västra Götaland in southwestern Sweden. Visited a place called Still Uppsala to this day, and there's over 100 different type of Uppsala, and even people have, you know, they've broken down the word, meaning it's what it really means is Uppsal, which means the upper hall. Some people have said it means Ubbsul, which means where the sun goes up sun. You know, so there's tons of things like this in the backdrop that's going. So I think there's a lot more to learn and discover before we can say anything definitely here. What's going on? As I said, there's so much more in your book, Robert, and we could go on for, you know, many more hours here and talk about all these things. But is there something you feel is important that we should kind of leave our audience with, something which you feel we have left out a little bit?
I don't think so, really. I'd possibly even just like to reiterate that about the sense of identity that they had throughout this period, that they were, I think there is a tendency for people to think that they were barbarians, you know, who very good at being barbarians, but just barbarians. I mean, one of the thrusts and the purposes of my book was to show that it really was, heathendom was not the lack of a culture. It really was its own culture, a rich and vibrant and interesting, fascinating culture. This was just not a Christian culture. And I think that it's very important to bear that in mind you know, try to see the richness of that period, the richness, the reality of the people. Read the skaldic poets. You read these poems, and you see the poet in front of you. You're almost there. You know, this stuff is so vivid. It's certainly one of the great periods of history. And I think that a lot of my Scandinavian friends, they pretend to be very sort of tutty about it, or what dreadful people they were, but I think secretly they're very proud of it, you know.
Yeah, do you think, this would be my critique growing up in Sweden. I think Norway and Denmark are more patriotic to a certain extent when it comes to the Viking area. They're more proud of it, but I feel that there is a lack. Again, I'm just speaking from personal experience here, but I remember how little I was taught when I went to school about, you know, Viking Scandinavia and what happened there. It to me, it feels like they've been trying to look the other way for a long time because they've been ashamed of the, let's say, the violence or the rawness of the time. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you could be right, you know, that it's something. I mean, I know in Norway that because the Nazis, when they rose, they pinched a lot of the kind of, they requisitioned a lot of lore associated with the Old North. So that for a generation after the war, that history was tainted. And that's one explanation, I think, why, you know, the Scandinavian black metal, I don't know if they have that phenomenon in Sweden, but certainly in Norway, there's a death metal, black metal, there's a gothic thing, which is really back to the Vikings. And that is really one way of winding up the 68 generation, you know, by kind of really embracing this kind of past, and as a deliberate provocation, because I mean it's so hard to provoke the tolerance, you know. But I think they found a way to do it.
Well, I welcome it. I think it's great that we touch back to these roots. I feel that to a certain extent we've been deracinated, and a lot of things have come in the way of, you know, projecting things on what it was or what it wasn't or what have you. It's there. We have to deal with it. I love it personally, and I see no reason to be shameful over any of this. And I, in fact, feel very proud over it. So I think that it is something that needs to be reawakened for us to kind of harken back to our identity a little bit. But just briefly speaking about that, I know you're writing a book on post-Viking Scandinavian culture as well, right? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it seemed almost that when I was wondering what to do next, it seemed almost the logical thing to do, you know. I ending my book in 1104 with the arrival of Christianity, and then, well, what's the next chapter? What happens over the next 1,000 years? Because I've lived in Norway for 30 years, so I almost feel I'm half Scandinavian. So this current book is, it's simply that. It's mostly going to be about the present state of Scandinavian society, because as you almost certainly know, being Scandinavian is very sexy now. The TV shows, the music, IKEA. This old idea of Scandinavians as sort of melancholy, gloomy people hidden away up in the north has completely disappeared. And also, it's very interesting to look at the way Christianity developed, which was originally, of course, Roman Catholicism. And then I find the Reformation fascinating, 1520, 1530, what happened up here, the introduction of Lutheranism and as a state religion. These things fascinate me, so I want to explore those things and see what influence they really have had on the development of the modern Scandinavian temperament.
Very interesting, fascinating. Well, keep us posted, Robert. Maybe we can have you back and talk more about that. I'd definitely be interested to hear what you find about that. But in the meantime, then the website, robertferguson.org, and the book we're talking about here is The Hammer and the Cross, A New History of the Vikings. And of course, it's available through the website. Well, thank you for coming on. And of course, thank you for writing the book as well and adding on to, you know, a lot of the things that have been lost about the Viking Age. So I really appreciate it. Thank you, Robert.
Well, thank you.
Our next program is with UK archaeologist Martin Biddle. We're going to proceed on the Viking Trail. He is the gentleman who, together with his wife, discovered the Viking burials at Repton in England. We're going to discuss how the great heathen army used the Anglo-Saxon church as part of their defense wall. We're going to speak more about the finds, the process, and speculate whether or not Ivar the Boneless, or Ivar Ragnarsson, one of the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok, was buried at Repton, as we have some fascinating reports of a 9-foot-tall giant skeleton being found there in the Viking burial mound. And Mr. Biddle did indeed find some exceptionally large bones for the time, and we'll go more into that, so don't miss that show. After that, we have Frank De Silva on Radio 314, Joaquin Flores on Red Ice Radio, and also coming up after that, John Lash, Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki, Marion Van Court, Dennis Fetcho, Jay Dreyer, Jeff Yates, and Laird Scranton. In the meantime, we say thank you so much for being a Red Ice member. We couldn't do this without you guys and gals, so thank you again. Well, have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll talk to you again in just a few. Take care.